lovely introduction and for inviting me down, Doug. It's great to be here. I'm going to rub salt in the wound now by reading a load of poems about Dublin, which none of you will want to hear, but I live in the north inner city in Dublin, and you have to try and find inspiration where you can. So a number of my poems are kind of based around that part of Dublin city centre. I have a book coming out this autumn, and I'm going to take you on a slightly backwards tour through the book. It's coming out with Dedalus Press, hopefully, in the autumn. It's going to be called Live You Swim. And I'm going to start with a couple of poems that are closer to the end of the book and then bring you back towards the beginning. So my first three poems are going to be these Dublin poems, and the first one is called If You Swim. It's going to be the title poem of my collection, and it's been published in a book called If Ever You Go, which is this year's Dublin One City One Book.
Yay, Dublin!
I'd be murdered if I didn't plug. There's lots of poems in it. They are all about Dublin, but lots of them are by poets from all over Ireland and much further afield, so it's definitely worth checking out if any of you want to, you know, see a bit of Dublin without having to go all the way up there. There's not much to see. So I'll start you off with Liffey Swim. In the dream, the Blessington Street basin fills with the Liffey stout bottle waters, but still the swimmers come, in droves, on the stray sovereign of an Irish summer's day. The river courses towards the quays, turning concrete roadways to canal banks that shrug their shoulders into dark water. A man rises, seal-like in his call of silt to wave. At the sluice gate where the river bends out of sight between toppling buildings, a black dog jumps again and again into water. And there, at the edge of vision, my parents, ready to join the swimmers, gesture their cheerful farewells. I was just talking earlier about how reams of paper are much more practical than having eight books, and already I'm having trouble. This next one is called Scenes from a Poor Town, and it's kind of really an impression of the part of Dublin in which I live. And it was published recently in a book called New Planet Cabaret, which was edited by Dave Norden, and lots of great stuff in that as well. So yeah, pick that up too. Scenes from a Poor Town. Streetlights turn the black world orange. The moon is a lie the canal repeats and repeats. A man on the bridge agrees, see his shape blacken the moon on water until it vanishes. Outside the derelict convent, a shape walks, white-bibbed, sharp-beaked, the street lamp caught in its eye. On the North Strand, bombs sleep under floorboards, below the tide line, nestled truffles. Their intricacies perennial, they glide through the night on greased rails, the dark hours, the slow hours. And this final Dublin poem is in memory of Peggy Mangan, who was a lady with Alzheimer's who went missing in Dublin last year and who was found in the kind of scrubland around IKEA out in Ballymun. And this is called IKEA Sleep. Miles of scrubland, subdividing subdivided estates, it's all distances here. A long walk from Tuesday's crowds to the blue broken view from the restaurant windows. To wait with patience is a quality shared by man, woman, dog, as is to fall out of memory, to break through that smokestack landscape, get lost in its low-flying clouds. Her shape was clear among the bushes once we got up close. So you can see I have a kind of ambivalent relationship with Dublin. It's not all funny games in the north inner city and further afield. This next poem is called The Lyrebird, and I saw a documentary, I think you can still get it on YouTube, it's a BBC documentary about the lyrebird, which is nature's best mimic. It's also one of the most endangered species of bird in the world, and it's found in the Australian bush. And the really sad irony about the poor lyrebird is that it spends most of its time now imitating the sounds of the machinery that's cutting down the bushland. So, start a thought for the poor lyrebird. The lyrebird. All day I have been practicing small sounds of annihilation. In the forest, not only the axemen hear the sound of falling trees. Me and the lyrebird stand in a clearing, mimicking the dock dock of hatchets, the banshee wail of chainsaws, speaking their words back to them in our mangled patois. Because when the end comes, isn't some kind of conversation the best we can hope for? This next one is called Crosses on the Road to Sligo, and it was published in the Irish Times recently, and I kind of got doorstopped by a man who lives near my parents, who's an ex-priest, who wanted to talk to me about all of the spiritual meaning in this poem, which is going to make me able to read it now every time I get the chance to explain that it's not about spirituality, it's not about Catholicism, it's about the fact that on the road between Carrick and Shannon and Sligo there are around 40 crosses marking the site of various fatal accidents. And I just thought, only in Ireland would this be our practical response to a really, really dangerous stretch. I mean, it's just horrible, really, really grotesque and strange. I've heard from some people in Sligo that they're changing the road now into a much wider piece of road. But still, in this day and age, this is how we respond to problems. So, crosses on the road to Sligo. At first we greet them with laughter, with the attitude of the day tripper, hard and sleek as the car we steer through these treacherous bends. There's a hypnotism to these crosses, an urging to recognise fatal trajectories, the tiny slips that bring spinning wheels to a stop, and they multiply, proliferating now at every bend, blind reminders of mortality, each room its own crossroads, marker of a choice unmade. On our return, we are quiet, carrying with us your brother, the surprising weight of human frailty, and as the lowering cloud lifts a pale eyelid above May's grave, and roadside bouquets wither in their plastic sheaths, we make our own crosses, though invisible, to carry with us in the mind's eye or on the shoulder. So this next poem, it's a recession poem, but really it's kind of hopefully bigger than that, and it's how it's about, in a way, I have the sense that you know, an old order has ended in Ireland to some extent, but really it's part of a greater trend that's taking part in the Western world and in Europe, and this is called The New Reality. We find ourselves in the imperial geometry of a Spanish square. High buildings, taller palms, the acid flash of a parakeet thrown across the strangely northern sky, this icy plain that's crept over the Iberian spring, a home sky, a Dublin Bay sky. We ask each other, is it so bad, this new reality, all of us scattered on maps without meaning, our constant poor mouth babble of phones and sites and links that don't quite catch each other in the acrobatic darkness. From the shaded archways, unseen penitentes watch, dead infantas flutter ivory fans. The shadows they've cast are fading into those chill skies as the movement of their atomic waltz slows out of existence. Back to Dublin for a little while, sorry. I've got two poems that are kind of about the legacy of the Magdalen Laundries. And the preamble for the first one is actually longer than the poem itself. I have to work on that. But the first one, I was listening to the radio and I heard a woman called Julie McClure talking about her experience in the Stanhope Street Magdalen Laundry. And it made me think about the fact that I think we all have this kind of strange, shadowy assumption that women were only put in the Magdalen Laundries when they got pregnant or when they did something wrong. But actually what was really going on was a church and state-sponsored system of indentured labour. And that was the experience of this woman. Her mother was approached when she was 14 years old and told that, you know, Julie would have the opportunity to come up to Dublin, get a great education, maybe she'd be able to go on and get secretarial work, something like that, an opportunity she wouldn't have had in her home. But she came up to Dublin and was kept in the laundry on Stanhope Street for 3 years, working at the laundry, and she wasn't given any kind of education at all. And so this is a girl who had done nothing wrong, and I think there are many hundreds and thousands of other women who've had a similar experience. And so this is called An Education in Silence. This morning's light spilled into the courtyard like God had opened a window. The light is quiet and can't be herded from dormitory beds to morning mass. It shines where it wants, blushing the stained glass windows, washing the priest's words. My mother doesn't write. It's been 3 years. My hands crack from the heat of the sheets as we feed them through the mangle. The high windows admit one square of light on the word repent, and I am silent like the sunlight. This next one's called Headline. All the letters escaped from the paper have been pixelated for our reading pleasure. No more the smudge of newsprint, that temporary stain like a kiss between comma and page, words blurred by fingerprints made, and that labyrinth momentarily defined by ink that defies all permanence. What's true this morning by night is pretty paper, my Ulysses reference. Or kindling, my 1980s childhood, or a blanket for a homeless man, that song they made us learn in religion class. And as I walk temple bars, rain-wet cobblestones, words glide along the channels, dissolve in oil-glazed puddles, and shout at me from acid-coloured posters, until the technicolour blurs to monochrome, and the great unwritten headline of our century roars from the hoarding on a derelict site, babies stolen. Babies stolen, suffering, suffering, suffering. The woman who woke into history. It was an ordinary morning in 1940 when she was struck by the 2,000 years between the Neolithic tombs, or the Neolithic road, and the Bronze Age tombs, smacked by millennia of Christianity, before which no one worried if their god was Catholic or Protestant. And the weight of these shifting definitions ploughed her into the ground between post holes and hearthstones, where, for a moment, she saw the thin line of it all glinting in the barrow like a whisper of sunlight on the shortest day. And she was awake in the midden-rich dark until the rampant squatties, in training for the burning of another flimsy epoch, rolled their tanks over her, right through the pathways of her new archaeology, and she forgot it all again. I got to go to Iceland last November. I wrote a couple of poems that I'm always a little bit blue about travel poetry, you know, it's kind of like making somebody sit through your holiday snaps or something like that. But when we were in Iceland, we were talking to a couple of people, and I discovered a couple of Irish connections. And so now I'm going to subject you all to my poetic holiday snaps. This is a sequence poem called Mitochondrial, and the idea comes from the notion that most of the mitochondrial DNA, which is the DNA found through the women's line, comes from Irish settlers. So most of the male settlers were Norse and the female settlers were Irish, so that got me thinking about how that all panned out. And a couple of little glosses. Þingvellir is the Icelandic kind of open-air parliament, a historic site where they all went and stood in the snow and worked things out. Yggdrasil is the Scandinavian tree of life. If any of you have seen the horror movies, you'll be well upon all that. Hallgrímskirkja is a church in Reykjavik, which for the purposes of this poem, I decided looked like a whale. So you know everything you need to know. Mitochondrial. Esja's saga. The first settler men were Norse, the women Irish. A pale-haired man tells us of Irish Esja's saga, points at her home across the bay among the wet-footed mountains. I look for her face through the drift of passing eons, but she vanishes from sight like a seal in green water. The man speaks of Þingvellir, King being place of law, like the old King moat on maps of Dublin, and this shared linguistic route makes a time bridge. A causeway long buried, but lit for a moment by the shared DNA of 1,000 dead Esjas. Yggdrasil flaring in crepuscular light. The Viking Wife. In school books, the Viking wife was always pick-platted, apple cheeks blushing pink in her seashell face. She offers a plate of bread, her homely skill the obverse of the rape, the slaughter, all bloodiness exported to the shores of neighbouring lands where the surf foamed pink. But Iceland tells a different story. Dull-haired Celtic wives, faces like slapped arses, noses running with cold, bawling with rage at their dead Irish men, at their new Norse husbands as they were dragged to this wind-whipped rock. Now when I recall the books, the ice flows clear and Esja stares from the pages, a thin-faced girl, her cola bottle full of beer, hair scrawled back in a ponytail, her Norseman dead, family 1,000 miles away. The scraping of this rock hers, the birch scrub behind her on fire in the night. Hallgrímskirkja. The Icelandic elders built their church from the body of a whale thrown from the bay by God's thunder. From the green depths she brought icebergs and plankton tattoos to mark her basalt walls with sacred text. From her bones they built the organ to sigh its krill song to her sisters in the bay. From her skin they wove carpets so fine and sea blue that when the sun shines an ocean moves among those who pray on their feet to the god of sailors, stranded now on a melting inland sea. From her oil they made 7 lamps that will burn until the end of days when the chosen will file between her ribs, into her belly, and be carried back to the glacier's heart to swim as the last ice melts, depths uncharted. Drink. Microphone nerves, you know, I think probably people in the room know that without a microphone I will talk very comfortably for an hour or two without stopping. So that's what I'm talking about. Just put a microphone in front of you and you get microphone dry mouth. This next poem was inspired by the experience of some of my friends who are worked on a panel of this 1913 lockout commemorative tapestry. Some of my friends from work are good with sewing and handicrafts and stuff like that, so they were taken on board to sew or embroider one of the panels, and the whole thing was designed by Robert Ballas, a lovely project, and lots of different groups from all over Dublin were involved in it. But there was a minor controversy over the historical accuracy of the design, which has inspired this poem. Larkin's beard. When the time came to stitch the tapestry commemorating 1913 and its lockout, controversy broke out over Larkin's beard. It was a fake, you see, worn to disguise him as he addressed the crowds from the window of the Imperial Hotel. And when the DMP men came to take him away, in the famous photo you see the beard sat on his face, shrouding that big mouth, casting spare light on his eyes. But when Bobby Ballas' sketches arrive for us to work up, Larkin is beardless. Our sewing circle sits, stares from photo to sketch, from long-jawed Larkin to the bearded gent of historical fact. We decide to sew on the beard. Each strand is stretched taut through the cloth, fingers are pricked, hardened, tendons pulled, but it's truth we're sewing. We follow the weave of history, bond over our small rebellion as we contour the moustache, gradate our silks from black to grey. When the woman from the committee comes and sees the beard, she is horrified by its hirsute challenge to the narrative we have been told to represent. And we all get a lecture on artistic license before the beard is removed. okay, let's see, where are we at? I'm going to read a Madrid sequence poem, which was recently published in The Weary Blues. And it's kind of inspired by the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but also about some of them. Well, without sounding too controversial, by some spectacularly monstrous egos. No names being named. From the diary of Dr. Jekyll, Jekyll and a Woman. She welcomes my Mr. Hyde, almost coaxes him over the threshold, though he needs no bidding. At first he is flummoxed by her stance, willow thin, yielding, and her movement as she makes to stroke his matted head. Her eyes shine like winter sunlight through the wiggly bonds of her hair, and my monster slavers and is still. Something connects. A Blakean bridge melds the very seconds between them. I open my mouth in time to disappear. Jekyll and the Child. Any act of creation is surely a miracle. The endurance of the human spirit, the splitting of the seed, the grafted root. But in the eyes that peer from the nursery doorway, there is spite, brute intelligence, the stolen toy, the tantrum, the dirty face. I excuse myself, wander to the garden to watch the swallows skim the grass, their blind flight finding its fill without malice. Jekyll's creation myth. Somewhere in the darkness is a dream of water. From it crawls the lizard that coughs up the sun. The sun gives the gift of leaves. It exhaled from the light and breathing it in turn. The lizard eats the leaves and grows green, and from the leaf shape comes man, the world's pet. But inside him live many worlds and many mirrors, distorting him so that his smile becomes a grimace. Because even in the waking world, the darkness is dreaming still. Okay. I'm going to read a couple of poems about love and various complications. I'm going to give you three of those and then let you off the book. And then we've got another three and then I'll finish up. And this first one is called Love, but with a big O. Of all the letters in the word love, only one is fit for a gift. Not L, the divider, E, the maze, or V, the two-fingered goodbye. I make for you an O, the vulnerable O of lips that enfold the welcoming spaces at the center of sharp-edged words. My gift for today, this O, the iris of the word I offer, opening silently to look at you. Pearl. Now we no longer have the pearl, it becomes difficult to invoke as anything more than a smooth white sphere. But it couldn't be just that, could it? This thing we held together and cherished as if something beautiful and new might crack through its skin and smile at us, congratulating our small act of creation. No, it must have had something swimming in it deep below its surface, sliding through its powdery depths, something that knew us. Otherwise, what was the pearl, and why did we hold it so carefully, like a flower baby or a cosseted egg used to prepare a boy and a girl for all the future and history a touch can spark? Letters from Mount Fuji. From the top of Mount Fujiyama, I send you letters, each one written on a square page and folded in as many different patterns as a snowflake. I drop them onto thin air, watch them fall into the world. Open one. In it is a picture from your childhood. You can look at it, but it melts in your hand like the question I ask you, caught on a breeze, and your answer taken by the river to the flat sea. Even through this constant, year-devouring snow, I will always send you letters. And the final three poems kind of bring us back to the first part of the book. The kind of inevitable, slightly autobiographical stuff that it's impossible to excise it from a first collection, I think. So these are a couple of poems just dealing with family and loss and illness and stuff like that, and challenges of becoming an adult. Are any of us there yet? Have you made it? I don't know. So there's three of these, and then I'll finish up. Just again, thank you for having me, guys. It's been really, really lovely, and a great audience. Very silent and attentive, but in a good way. I'm hearing nice little oohs and ahs. I love the little poetry oohs and ahs, which are always very nice to have. So thanks again, and this is a 1914 house. There are aches in these walls, that much I can feel. 100 years of slump and settlement. The glass in the sashes casts bleary glances on the garden, washing the lawn in river water glamour. After your first turn, running across O'Connell Street, you came back here to feel your way through things. The worn oak of the fireplace, cast iron tea warmers in the grate, trip hazards, a stair shallower than the rest, a loose tile, a visual language disintegrating, and the rooms in your mind, full since the house was built, empties, with no one to fill them again. My aunt reads the tarot. She frowns at my mother, fans the cards across our vinyl tablecloth. They make a sound like sighing, like they have secrets too terrible to disclose. My aunt's face pauses in its reel of expressions, and we know her son is off his meds again, looking for gear and old haunts. In our steamed-up kitchen, my cards were always weeping women, snowbound churches, meetings on dark evenings with whispered messages. In my teenage years, she gave me the cards, wrapped in black silk, torn from a blouse, and they fell behind my bed among CDs, unread books. Now, they're gone. Our futures stay wrapped in silk. but the fool still stands on my dresser, a young man waltzing toward the cliff edge. And I'll finish with The Disappearing Garden, which was published in Sexford, I think, at the end of 2012. The Disappearing Garden. Now we are eucalyptus shaded, foxglove dappled, living half in and half out of the light. But when you close your eyes, the garden isn't there. Attempts to summon it bring only memories of churned earth, of a past when this garden was unimaginable. And so, opening your eyes brings something like loss in reverse, the subtle but bone-shaking shock, the moment when everything appears. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jessica.